We begin, however, as always on a Monday, with our political commentators, and it's Stephen Mills and Bridget Morton today. Kia ora korua, welcome.
Morena.
Morena.
And just your disclaimers, or just your descriptions, really, as always. Stephen is Executive Director at Talbot Mills Research Limited, the polling firm used by Labour, a former political advisor to two Labour governments. Bridget Morton is a director with public and commercial law firm Franks and Ogilvie, and a former senior ministerial advisor for the previous National-led government. We'll come to polls in a moment because they are kind of interesting. We've had, for once, a decent batch all in one time, but let's just park that, kick off with the big decisions that are coming this next week or so, and a transition that is really going to test the government as a communication exercise, as well as a response to where things are at in this pandemic. Bridget, do you want to begin with today? Of course, they've got to decide whether or not they're going to have another slight shift in the Auckland levels. There seems to be a lot of advice coming from experts, no, leave it till next Monday, where it's anticipated they'll announce the moving of Auckland into this new traffic light system. What do you see as the really big issues ahead now?
Well, I think you've hit on the nail on the head there with the communication strategy, because I think what's really fallen over is the understanding from people, A, what even the plan is. So I think I saw in the News Hub poll last night that 2/3 of people don't understand the traffic light system. Second of all, you know, people not understanding what those sort of triggers are, what those things are that are going to mean whether or not we move, and, you know, if we move forward or not. And I felt particularly confused this morning by, you know, Jacinda Ardern's assurances now that the DHBs completely and utterly could cope over summer once the sort of Auckland border is opened and they tested all that, without giving us actually any indication of what has really changed from even like a week ago, when they were saying that we must keep things locked down and we're very concerned because we don't think, particularly in low vaccination areas, that, you know, our hospitals and our medical system can cope. So for me, the big issues are really about communicating to people so they're on board with the plan, but also making sure that people actually understand what their responsibilities and obligations are.
On that point, if I recall the same bit of the interview I was listening to, was there not a bit of a proviso or a bit of a hint again that there might be some kind of protection still around some areas? Was that not adjunct to that comment?
Well, I did sort of pick up on that as well, and that they were talking, I think they said they were particularly talking to sort of low vaccinated areas, people who, you know, particularly iwi who had, you know, already put out statements saying, please don't come to our areas, whānau, Upanui, Northland, etc. But there wasn't really any assurances about what was happening sort of differently in those areas, that they were actually, were they really beefing up the health system? Was there going to be more availability there of, you know, testing or just beds or, you know,
would there be some kind of a border? Would there be some kind of a border around them, which had also been mooted? Instead of trying to put a border around a city where 40,000 people are going to leave in a day, if you've got an area you're really concerned about, that's where you might have some kind of a check border.
Yeah, but once again, we don't have sort of really indication that that might be the plan. So, for instance, I've said Aucklanders can leave, but if your plan is to go and visit your family, you know, up in Northland over Christmas, you know, you think, oh, great, I can leave Auckland. But if you can't get to your family, nothing's really changed for you.
Yeah. The border would be, though, again, about checking vaccination and or negative test status. Stephen, it really is a really big transition point. How are you reading what's riding on this next week or two in every way?
I think a huge amount's riding on it. I mean, just quickly on the traffic light system, I think it's, you know, quite fashionable now to kind of criticise and sneer at it because people don't understand it, but it is. I think this, you know, that's kind of almost a bit sort of silly because it is dealing with a much more complex challenge and a much more infectious virus. And there's like a huge number of things to take into account. You know, there's the pressure on the hospitals, which is obviously still the most critical thing. You know, kind of likely death rate, the Māori death rate, racial discord generally. And I agree that situation on the Northland border is unclear and would be a distinct kind of really uncomfortable feeling if you were trying to head up there at the moment until things get a bit clearer. The variable vaccination rates across the country, the cost of business subsidies if you continue lockdowns, the pressure that coming from business to open up, including in Northland. The Auckland capacity to withstand, you know, further lockdowns and the decline in compliance, pressure on people in home isolation. Now, all that needed to be taken into account before the kind of plan was developed and announced. And, you know, the die is now cast, I guess. The ideal in government is to have a plan and be thought to have a plan. At least you should have the plan. I think that's where the government is now. And it has got some communications work to do to get across to people that there is one.
The unknowns of how this system is going to work. And I'm not even talking here about the communications. I'm talking about the reality when the pass takes effect and a retailer has a choice of either being in the system and having no limitations or being not in the system and perhaps only being able to do contactless, which will be the case at one of these levels. Even knowing what they can do at different levels, they have to get their heads around that. But the big question, Bridget, is how these businesses are going to enforce these vax passes.
Yeah, and that's one of the key issues is the fact that they have said now, you know, we've had several weeks at least of, you know, the traffic light system being one that, you know, is what we're moving towards. Thankfully, we've got vaccine passports now available to most people, although there's still some latency in the system. But the main thing is that people, the legislation, actually the framework around this, we have not seen. It's probably going to almost definitely go through under urgency with very little scrutiny. And the problem is basically Parliament will put this through and then we'll rise for the summer. It will happen, chaos may ensue, may not ensue, people will be confused, and Parliament doesn't sit again until February. So they've really got to get it right now. And with having so little visibility on actually what that looks like, I think it really heightens the chances of getting it wrong.
Go ahead, Stephen.
We're just saying, I think announcements are due on that this week. Work is clearly being done on it. And I think the vaccine pass has gone really well. I mean, there's so many things that were predicted to be a complete disaster, and so much happens during a pandemic. You just criticise right across the front and you'll be right sometimes and then just move on when you're wrong. Vaccine pass is going really well as far as I can make out. I did it and it was incredibly easy process.
Well, fair point, actually. And I think they pulled that together, the actual company that's done it, in about 6 or 7 weeks. But that leads to another question. Perhaps if we let some of these smart companies do a bit more, there are other things that could happen. But other really big test of all this, and can we acknowledge also there's only so much a government can ever prescribe. This is messy and mucky no matter how you look at it. Businesses and schools and everybody else, every employer has had to engage and get their heads around how they are going to do what is required of them. It can't all be articulated right down to the bottom sentence, you know, on a page, right?
But in saying that, though, they haven't provided the framework for, you know, people, you know, I was discussing with friends over the weekend about sort of looking at what's happening across the world and how people are self-managing the issues. And you look here in New Zealand, if I wanted to be ultimately responsible, I'm double vaccinated, I, you know, sign in everywhere I go, all of those things. But I don't have the availability of, you know, getting a rapid antigen testing, which they're commonly used, you know, across Europe. So people can test, you know, if they think they might have something that they need to go further or, you know, self-isolate. You know, the saliva testing, which has a much lower barrier to people actually using it, it's more willingness to get tested, seems to be stuck in some sort of bureaucratic perjury, so it's not available. Why are we setting up, why is the government not allowed a more sort of open framework so that people who do want to be really responsible, do want to protect their family and their vulnerable ones over Christmas, have the tools in order to do it?
Early on, they're obviously quite uncomfortable about the accuracy of antigen testing. I don't know whether that's moved on. Saliva testing is kind of being used in some places for the border staff and so on. I mean, I think things will go wrong and there's always criticisms of the process. But if you look at the overall record, a 0.7% per 100,000 death rate, 7 in Australia, 214 in UK, 232 in USA. A lot of the criticisms, you'd think their bodies being burnt in funeral pyres in New Zealand streets. The economy overall is performing strongly. It's not taking way that a lot of people have suffered really badly, but there's a lot of winners from COVID. I talk to them in the work I do and they're quite embarrassed by it, but a lot of people come up with accounts of how their business has never gone better. And the fact that the economy is the same size as it was prior to COVID, despite the loss of the tourism and international student sector and other issues, shows that there must be kind of people doing well out there. There was huge criticisms of the low vaccination rate early on, were kind of mocked in that for the OEC failure there. But now that's come through and it's quite a high rate compared to the rest of the world. There's, you know, high testing per case. That's higher than anywhere else in the world. And outside Auckland, there's been minimal restrictions since the first lockdown. You know, overall, on the very big picture, and I'm not in any way backing away from mistakes have been made and some things are hard to explain, it has been a success story. That may not, you know, be the case in a couple of months, which is why I think the die is cast now on, you know, how this is going to play out with this latest plan. But, you know, the overall kind of performance of the government has been really really good. And even on the most kind of unpopular things, you know, if you look at the kind of polling, you know, the 74% support in that Colmar-Brunton poll, which we'll come to, for vaccine mandates. And the kind of myth that, you know, everything's going well overseas, you know, John Key sneering at the Hermit Kingdom along with others. You know, look what's happening in kind of Austria and Germany and Netherlands now. Austria is moving to mandatory vaccination. You know, God knows what that'll kind of like lead to in terms of protest, but they obviously think it's necessary.
Okay.
And Singapore is making the unvaccinated pay for their treatment.
Okay, let's just touch. We have had some of these protests. We've had some incidences where MPs have clearly felt unsafe in being confronted. And I know the Speaker has moved on things like security at Parliament. But again, Bridget, when you look at it overall, some of these protests have gone ahead with no great drama or incident, including two groups sort of, you know, confronting each other in the capital yesterday. I know there's a lot of frustration in Auckland that people haven't been arrested over some of the protests that have been held up there, but police will have their own logic on what the best outcome is going to be and whether going in heavy would have been counterproductive. Overall, the sort of febrile mood in some parts of the population, is it relatively contained again? There's an enormous amount of understandable fatigue and frustration in Auckland. But overall, are we looking at a relatively contained situation when it comes to some of the most extreme stuff?
I think the most extreme stuff, absolutely. And I think, you know, the threats of violence and things like that are at the extreme end. And we're probably seeing a greater visibility of that type of behaviour because of digital media and social media that, you know, basically allows, before you could never, you know, really speak almost directly to a person in the media or a politician unless you saw them on the street. Now you can fire off an email from an anonymous account super easily. But I think what we need to be really careful, though, and I see a little bit around, you know, the discussion about protests and particularly sort of the groundswell one yesterday, that they must be some sort of extreme group. But when you look at some of the sort of secondary polling information that's coming through, you know, people are quite pessimistic about where the sort of country is going. You know, increasingly people are negatively responding about how the government has, you know, handled the COVID response or how they think they're going to handle it going forward. They think that, you know, the worst of the pandemic is still to come. They think that, you know, the negative effect on the economy is still to come. So I think, you know, you've got your extremes, but I think we shouldn't be, you know, allowing that to blind us from the people in the middle that are overall suffering. And, you know, I think police put out stats the other week that they've had something like a 50% increase on the last quarter for mental health call outs. And we know that the police are only going to the most extreme mental health call outs. You know, domestic violence is up, all of those things. So I worry a little bit the protest and the protesters kind of suck the oxygen out of there a little bit. And the sort of people stuck in lockdowns or their businesses are suffering and not being seen as much.
I did sort of standard presentations for a number of years showing New Zealand, you know, was very positive on whether it was heading in the right track or wrong direction compared to most other countries, which had, you know, either seriously negative like the United States or bounced around like Australia. And you know, now we've seen in at least one poll that's gone into negative, not in our polling, but clearly the kind of mood has changed. What sort of gets me is how fast it is. I know I understand the anxiety of what we've been through as a country for the last kind of coming up for 2 years, but the descent into at least minority craziness is, you know, kind of really disappointing. We seem to be mimicking American insanity at the fringes with talk about child trafficking and so on, and the violence, threats against the journalists, that stuff against Kieran McNulty I watched on social media, that was quite chilling. You know, how do you want to be killed, basically? And you sort of wonder what you have to do in terms of threatening people to get an appropriate police response. And what I don't understand too is, you know, like groundswell and or whatever it is, howler protest, I think they've got a weak case, you know, in dealing with issues at sort of glacial pace, such as water quality and climate change, and the farming leadership's behind change in that area. But where did that kind of hatred and viciousness and the misogyny and racism come, which they kind of, you know, is very evident in the first wave, and they work really hard to conquer, but not completely in the second wave? And why do concerns about balance between human rights and individual rights on vaccination mandates? I mean, I don't get why people don't want to be vaccinated, given how many tens of millions of lives they've saved over the years. But, you know, given that position, you can see why you'd be upset about losing your job. But why does that spill over into madness?
But Stephen, you're talking about potentially a tiny minority of people, including in a protest. And as a journalist, I can tell you, of course, you're going to take photographs and news images of the most radical banners or placards that you see there. And really, you know, even, you saw within the farming community itself saying, hey, this is not the right time, the best time to be doing this protest for multiple reasons. But, you know, we can be savvier than to extrapolate a small number and make it sound like it's becoming a big deal, can't we? Without equally underestimating the frustrations that might be out there.
I think it has been a descent into something we haven't seen before, and that may be that kind of social media is the first time it's influenced when there has been some dissatisfaction around. I mean, I agree we do need to keep perspective, and maybe I'm not, you know, only 3% of people in our latest survey said they definitely won't get vaccinated, and there was strong support and, you know, consistent strong support for vaccine mandates and polls. But, it, you know, one thing, you know, sort of maybe a final comment on it, they should make up their mind whether the government's fascists or Nazis, you know, that they massacred millions of each other in the Second World War. It's got to be one or the other, not both.
Maybe, yeah. Just maybe too much thought going into how frustrations are really expressed. Yeah.
I'd be really interested to hear what Bridget has to say on that, on where the National Party is in it, because I think Chris Bishop's taken, you know, a totally responsible role as the COVID spokesperson, but Judith Collins herself, Simeon Brown, Simon O'Connor, Hariti Apango, Maureen Pugh and so on, what the National Party Liberals themselves call the Taliban, you know, they've been nodding and winking to the anti-vaxxers quite strongly. And I think, you know, this, it's completely sort of gut approach. I can understand the votes.
Let Bridget speak to it then.
Well, I think one of the things is that you've kind of over-egged again what is sort of coming out, you know, this wink and nod to the anti-vaxxers. We kind of come back to this point when the opposition is asking legitimate questions. So, for instance, what is the runway on vaccine mandates and the use of vaccine passports? You know, how do they plan? What is the steps out of that system? That doesn't mean they don't support vaccine passports or the use of, you know, mandates in some circumstances. So I think, once again, this kind of, you know, you talk about, you know, the descent into, you know, you get these crazies on the outside. The more you use polarizing and factionalizing language like that, the more you push people into silos rather than actually having a discussion. So I find that really frustrating. I think, you know, really back in the beginning of sort of, you know, April last year, there was a lot of pushback on any questions that were asked about COVID. What I think now is a much more healthier, you know, discussion I see amongst, you know, people out on the street, not necessarily, you know, in opinion columns, about actually some of these legitimate questions. And I really encourage that, because that is how we're going to start stepping out of the situation we're in.
Okay, let's get to the poll. Stephen, let's move on. Let's get to the polls. The one that caught my eye last night was actually the News Hub, the Three News Hub Red Research poll, because we'd had a fairly consistent story, correct me if I'm wrong, from the Talbot Mills poll that came out, the Taxpayer Union funded Courier that came out, and the Colmar Brunton that came out. There was a fairly common story of Labor coming down again and National making a bit of a recovery, especially in the polls that had been furthest back on, ACT coming in at a very, very healthy around 16%. The Reid research taken a bit more recently last night would have disappointed National, Bridget, because Labor had only come down a fraction and National had actually lost a bit of ground too. Now, within margin of error stuff, to be clear, but it wouldn't have given any reassurance that the turn is on for National.
No, and I think that's the absolutely right, that, you know, if Labor's losing votes, National should be picking them up, and that should be them, you know, taking the time to consider what their approach is and sort of what they need to be sort of talking through. I think legitimately, though, across all these polls, sort of as long as sort of National stays under 30%, they're not going to have that alternative government, you know, look about them. People are not going to approach them from that kind of point of view. So their votes are going to go to ACT, because ACT is, you know, making really strong statements. They're sort of capturing that frustration and that, you know, some of that rhetoric, and not just on COVID, but on, you know, housing and things like that, that they're sort of doing that sort of thing really well. I suspect as we get closer to the election and the pragmatism of actually how you would implement some of those things and what that would look like in government, may see it move back to National. But at the moment, it's completely National's responsibility to get those polls above 30%.
You know, I think that's likely that ACT vote, especially if National change to an acceptable leader for ACT, the voters that have gone to ACT, that vote will go back. Yeah, I agree with you, Catherine. It was quite interesting from the consensus of those kind of four earlier polls, including the Morgans one, was there was, you know, Labor going down and some drift from Labor to the Greens, so it wasn't you know, all going across the divide. Some were staying within the centre left. Now it's probably voters a bit destabilised by the more rapid pace of the opening up from the government. And in those polls, ACT was steady and National seemed to be kind of stemming the bleeding, whereas that News Hub poll, I think part of it was because it hadn't been reported since August. And I always think it's silly to kind of like report your polls as if nothing, no other polls have been released in the meantime when a whole lot have. Because I do think the picture for ACT at the moment is not saying they can't build from the current base, but they have steadied. And I think National probably has steadied as well. So the other thing from the News Hub poll was that was different was that Simon Bridges appeared not particularly strongly, but at 2.5%, that's been his biggest number. Whereas the Colmar Brunton poll, you know, was just absolutely terrible for Judith Collins, probably captured most, and it hasn't been seen in other polls as narrow as this, but only being 1% ahead, 5% to 4% on preferred Prime Minister ahead of Christopher Luxon. But I mean, I'm kind of amazed, and I don't necessarily think it's going to last, that the centre-right has stayed behind the centre-left. I think given the tone of the media, MIQ stories, angry business people, you know, reports on service failures, all the other things that are kind of dominating the news at the moment, you'd have thought that would have had more serious impact on the Labour vote.
Time will tell, as they say. Thanks, both of you. We'll return another time to this conversation about the wider program the government has and the pressure that's putting on the public service and on its own ministers. We'll come back and give that a thorough going over another time. Thanks, both of you, very much. Stephen Mills and Bridget Morton.